Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Jeremy Brecker, co-editor of the book In the Name of Democracy, American War Crimes in Iraq and Beyond, who discusses investigations into U.S. war crimes and the responsibility of citizens to challenge their government's violation of international law. Mavis Anderson of the Latin America Working Group, who talks about the fate of a recent amendment introduced in the Senate to stop enforcement of the U.S. travel ban against Cuba. And California State Representative Fran Pavley, who describes the battle now being waged over landmark automobile fuel efficiency standards in her state. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The BBC reports acting Iraqi Human Rights Minister Narmeen Uthman is investigating the use of white phosphorus by U.S. troops in the siege of Fallujah in November 2004. Pentagon spokesman Colonel Barry Venable recently confirmed the use of white phosphorus as an incendiary weapon against enemy combatants and for lighting up the night sky. Earlier, the U.S. State Department claimed the weapon was only used in Fallujah for illumination. White phosphorus is a highly flammable agent and ignites on contact with oxygen. When it hits a human being, it will burn flesh. Its use against civilians is prohibited by Protocol 3 of the Convention on Certain Conventional Weapons, a treaty the U.S. government has not signed. The controversy over the use of white phosphorus in Fallujah broke with the recent Italian television documentary, Fallujah: The Hidden Massacre, which quotes a human rights activist talking about how a rain of fire fell over the city. During the two-week siege of Fallujah, 50 American troops, an estimated 800 civilians, and 1,200 insurgents were killed. In the March 2005 edition of Field Artillery, officers from the 2nd Infantry's support team boasted about their use of white phosphorus during combat operations. During one firefight, they claimed, quote, "We fired shake-and-bake missions at the insurgents, using white phosphorus to flush them out and high explosives to take them out," unquote. The combined crises of the Asian tsunami, Hurricane Katrina, and the massive earthquake in Pakistan-controlled Kashmir are forcing humanitarian aid agencies to scramble to raise millions of dollars for relief. In recent months, critics find some of the aid appeals feature what they are saying are inappropriate images of naked victims that rely on outdated stereotypes. Referring to this practice as development pornography, Nikki Vandergog, a freelance writer and editor, told Reuters that many aid agencies have lowered their standards over the last 10 years, adding, "You have to think, would I like my picture or my child's picture taken like this?" Critics point to images of starving women and children that circulated in the Western media during the food crisis in Niger. Peter Davis of Oxfam said pictures from Africa were selected using different standards from those that would apply elsewhere. He added, "Using pictures of bare-breasted women in a society where the only other place we see that is salacious tabloids is not acceptable." Major European aid agencies are planning to release new fundraising guidelines in November 2006 to promote best practices without harming the dignity of victims. 20 million acres of public land could be sold if a proposed change in federal mining law is adopted. The provision, sponsored by House Republicans, would overturn a congressional ban on allowing mining corporations or individuals to buy public land at discounted prices if the land contains mineral deposits. As Dave Albersworth, public lands director for the Wilderness Society, told the Associated Press, it could literally lead to the privatization of millions of acres of public land, including national parks and forests. A repeal of the ban on government land sales could lead to a loss of an additional 14 million acres of land to mining. All it would take to file a claim is the potential of a profitable mining deposit. California Senator Dianne Feinstein has called on House Republicans to table the mining provision. She claims it would allow small groups to carve out numerous private enclaves within our public lands. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
In the aftermath of the September 11th terrorist attacks, the Bush administration justified a whole range of foreign and domestic policies that either skirted or directly violated U.S. constitutional law or international treaties such as the Geneva Conventions. From President Bush's defiance of the United Nations in launching his war against Iraq to official policies that led to the torture and mistreatment of detainees, America's image as a defender of human rights has been severely tarnished. Photos of Iraqi detainees being tortured at Abu Ghraib prison, alongside accounts of mistreatment at U.S.-run detention centers in Afghanistan and Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, have provoked lawsuits and investigations. While Washington's covert rendition of prisoners to third nations for the purpose of torture and recent press reports alleging U.S. secret prisons in Eastern Europe have only inflamed hatred and fear of the U.S. government. A recent Italian television documentary charging that the U.S. military used napalm and white phosphorus weapons in the 2004 siege of Fallujah are just the latest set of disturbing accusations undermining America's standing in the world community. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Jeremy Brecker, co-editor of the book In the Name of Democracy, American War Crimes in Iraq and Beyond. Brecker, a historian, discusses investigations into U.S. war crimes and the responsibility of ordinary citizens to challenge their government's violation of international law.
The book is about a very disturbing topic, which is the evidence for the United States is involved in committing war crimes in Iraq, and then trying to deal with what that means, how we address that and come to terms with it, both as a country and as individuals, what our responsibilities are, what we can do about it. And range of war crimes are really the range that has been many different kinds of crimes that have been identified at the Nuremberg tribunals after World War II and by the Geneva Conventions and the United Nations Charter and many international agreements that our country is part of. And actually also many of them are crimes under United States law, like the War Crimes Act and the Anti-Torture Act. These are crimes like torture, like making an aggressive war. The Iraq War itself, as Kofi Annan said very explicitly, was illegal. It was a violation of the UN Charter. And daily we read news about families being wiped out. There's recently been a major Italian documentary exposing the use of an illegal weapon, white phosphorus, against civilians. The government says it was, yes, it did use white phosphorus, but just for flares and illumination. But the Italian documentary has pictures of the flesh melting on these families and kids. So the reality that we're facing and confronting here is of the same kinds of things that are charged against Milosevic and charged against Saddam Hussein, not necessarily on the same scale, but our country has been led into those kinds of actions. And the administration has very much blamed where it's admitted some degree of prisoner abuse and other abuses. It's blamed it on the young men and women, people who have gone and made great sacrifices personally, and then they are being blamed for things like Abu Ghraib by the very people who have set the policies, the very top officials who have set the policies that have led things like Abu Ghraib to happen.
Jeremy, talk a little bit, if you would, on this seemingly shocking tact of the Bush administration. Vice President Cheney has gone to Congress and basically wants a legal exception made to allow mistreatment of detainees abroad by U.S. intelligence officers. It seems like they are so arrogant and brazen to do what really virtually no other country, no matter how despotic, has ever done before.
From the time of the beginning of U.S. going into Afghanistan, the top officials in the Bush administration have been obsessed with torture, but have also been obsessed with the need to protect themselves against legal charges for conducting torture. Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez, then White House attorney, the president's attorney, wrote a memo saying what we have to do is just declare that the Geneva Agreement Accords, which are the most fundamental international law governing treatment of civilians, treatment of prisoners, of war, basically what you can and cannot do, we just have to say that it doesn't apply. We just have to, as he said, opt out. And the reason that Gonzalez gave was because the American War Crimes Act might be used by a special prosecutor in the future to prosecute American officials for war crimes. This whole apparatus with Cheney and torture is in large part because there is vast evidence that they are already in violation of the law. There is certainly enough evidence to bring indictments against top United States officials for torture and other war crimes. And there is lots of evidence indicating that the policies that allowed this or encouraged it go to the highest levels of the Bush administration. And I think they have every reason to be afraid.
Jeremy, you discuss in the book some of the moral questions about citizens and their responsibilities in time of war, particularly when their nation breaks international law or commits human rights abuses. If you were to put it in a nutshell, what's the average citizen's responsibility in a time like we're living through now in the U.S.?
Well, you know, when the Nazi concentration camps were discovered and the Nazi war crimes were exposed, there was a phrase that was used, where were the good Germans? Where were the people you would have expected to stand up to this? And I think that's a question we've all learned to ask ourselves, or certainly should have learned to ask ourselves. This is a problem not just for Germans. It's not a problem just for Serbs. It's not a problem just for people of any one or another country. People in many countries have been placed in the moral situation of having their government engaged in war crimes. The first thing is that top government officials are directly accountable. This is the principle that was established in Nuremberg and has continued to be a central practice of international law, as it is, of course, of national law. If crimes are committed by people by people at the bottom, the people at the top who instructed them to do so or allowed them to do so are responsible. However, it goes beyond that because really, if we know about what's going on or should know about it or could know about it, unless we tried not to, then we have an affirmative obligation to take measures to bring those crimes to a halt. And again, this is a broad principle of national law and of international law. It's formulated in Nuremberg. It's not just government officials who are responsible. If we're in a position to do anything about it and we don't, then we are not meeting our responsibilities and we are essentially complicit with criminal acts. And what affirmative measures we're in a position to take obviously differs for different people.
That was Jeremy Brecker, co-editor of the book In the Name of Democracy, American War Crimes in Iraq and Beyond, published by Metropolitan Books. In an October 20th Senate debate on the Treasury Department budget, Senator Byron Dorgan, a Democrat from North Dakota, reintroduced his amendment to cut funding for enforcement of the travel ban against Cuba. However, before members of the state engaged in full debate on the issue, Senator John Ensign, a Republican from Nevada, succeeded in introducing a second-degree amendment to Senator Dorgan's proposal. Senator Ensign's amendment was related to the issue of parental consent for abortions. Given the controversial nature of the abortion issue, Senator Dorgan ultimately withdrew his proposal and criticized Ensign's maneuver as arbitrary and anti-democratic. Both U.S. citizens and members of Congress are increasingly supportive of free and open travel to Cuba. However, the Bush administration recently tightened travel restrictions by limiting trips by Cuban Americans to visit their families in Cuba to once every 3 years and only with special permission. Your reporter, Denise Manzari, spoke with Mavis Anderson, senior associate with the Latin America Working Group, who talks about the fate of the Dorgan Amendment and what her group will be doing to combat the ongoing travel ban by the United States against Cuba.
Senator Ensign's amendment had to do with abortion, nothing to do with Cuba, nothing to do with travel. Its sole purpose was to put the senators from both sides of the aisle in muddy waters and force the withdrawal of the amendment. his action was procedurally legal, but really unbelievable, as Senator Dorgan said. And had it been challenged, it probably could have fallen to a point of order since it was not germane. But the fact that it was on abortion was what was so confusing, because senators who support abortion and don't support travel to Cuba were put in a strange position, and senators who support travel to Cuba but would not have voted for a freestanding amendment on abortion were put in a bad position. So it was an untenable combination. So Senator Ensign, who doesn't have a bone to pick in this issue, has been the one who's been identified as the point person to make sure that this kind of amendment does not happen. And actually, I know that one of his constituents, one of Senator Ensign's constituents, called him to complain and asked what in the world he was doing. And his staff person very clearly said to this constituent, this amendment wasn't about abortion. This amendment was simply to get the Cuba travel amendment off the floor. And it worked. And Senator Dorgan was very gracious. He did say in his withdrawal speech that he felt it was unbelievable, and he said elementary and high school students should all be watching today to see just how politics in this country really work.
As time goes on, actually, more and more U.S. citizens and Congress members as well seem to support free and open travel to Cuba, and yet, you know, this maneuver certainly undermined Senator Dorgan's attempt at stopping the travel ban.
The Congress, in a bipartisan way, in fact, often with Republican leadership, has been working for 5 years to end or ease the ban on travel to Cuba. Polls show that the American people favor that by some 70%. Polls show that the Cuban-American community in South Florida, in their majority, favor easing the travel ban, especially the ban on family travel. And votes in both the House and Senate have in the past been bipartisan and strong in favor of it. And what happens? Other procedural measures and backdoor maneuvers are taken that remove language that passes in both the House and the Senate and comes to conference and the Republican leadership discards it. That's not democracy. That does not respect the will either of the Congress or of the American people. And it has to end.
In Dorgan's speech, he also said that he feels that this was just a small setback in efforts to end the travel ban. What is your opinion?
I think that there will continue to be efforts. Certainly, Congress will continue in this effort, and the non-governmental organizations who work with Congress, like the Latin America Working Group, will continue in this effort. But under this administration, we keep butting our heads up against a stone wall. And in this and other issues, I think we all have seen that it's a pretty obstinate and arrogant administration that does not bow to opinions other than their own. So it was a setback, yes. It's not the end of the game, but I'm not sure I'd call it minor.
What about Latin America Working Group? What will you be doing regarding this issue?
Well, we will continue to work legislatively in providing information and education to the members of Congress. We will continue to work with constituents in helping them to make their voices heard. We will continue to work with Cuban Americans who want to be able to visit their families. We will work with educators who want to be able to do study abroad trips to Cuba. We will work with cultural groups who are very eager for cultural and artistic exchange with Cuba. So what we're probably doing is taking it in smaller bites, but all of those are important pieces. I think that the key here is that from a government, the United States government, who consistently criticizes Cuba for being non-democratic and heavy-handed, for us then to resort to these kinds of undemocratic and behind-closed-doors kinds of methods to thwart the will of the American people, I think is just a travesty.
That was Mavis Anderson, Senior Associate with the Latin America Working Group. For more information, contact the group by calling area code 202-546-7010 or visit their website at www.lawg.org. Many motorists confronting the recent spike in gasoline prices are sitting up and paying attention to fuel efficiency, some for the first time. But the federal government is still dragging its feet regarding fuel economy standards, and years ago the initiative passed to the states. California passed a landmark global warming bill in 2002 that also increases fuel efficiency standards. It's called the Pavley Law after its main sponsor, Fran Pavley. Pavley was elected to the California State Assembly in 2000, where she is an outspoken defender of the environment. Her bill requires automobile manufacturers to reduce tailpipe emissions by 30% by the year 2016, beginning with the 2009 model year. Similar legislation has been passed in half a dozen other states, mostly in the Northeast. Although the bill was enacted into law, signed by the former governor, and supported by the current governor, it is now tied up in litigation brought by an alliance of automotive interests. The outcome is uncertain. California, with its large share of the auto market, has enormous influence on the development of auto technology nationally and internationally. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Pavley during a Clean Vehicles and Global Warming conference in Hartford, Connecticut on October 24th. She describes the broad coalition organized to get her legislation passed and the forces aligned against it in a state with 36 million residents and 25 million cars.
It was a broad-based coalition. It started out with primarily just environmental groups here, Natural Resources Defense Council, etc. And it got broadened to include health organizations who understood the impact and relationship between climate change and health issues such as asthma. And then amazing other groups came on board. I particularly enjoyed working with the Silicon Valley entrepreneurs, the venture capitalists from the heart of California's economy. And they saw that California taking the lead in new technologies would be in their best economic interest. They brought a whole new dynamic and perspective to the halls of the Capitol in supporting this bill. So it wasn't just an environmental bill. It was in California's best interest economically to move forward. Other groups involved, besides Hollywood celebrities and politicians, local cities and counties passing resolutions in support of California moving forward, but also a group of religious leaders, 160 religious leaders from Christian, Muslim, and Jewish faiths, Interfaith Council, brought a whole different perspective to this, talking about morally that California, United States should be protecting the earth. And they actually met individually with different legislators, depending upon their faith, to discuss this with them, took out full-page ads. But that brought a whole new dynamic as well to the discussion on climate change and why we should move forward.
So the bill was passed in 2002, signed by the governor, the former governor, Gray Davis, and the regulations adopted unanimously by the California Air Resources Board in 2004, but it's still being opposed, and there's litigation going on right now trying to stop it, I guess. Can you talk about what's happening right now?
After the regulations were adopted unanimously under the leadership of a new governor, so we've had both Democratic and Republican governors supporting these regulations. In December of 2004, the big three automobile manufacturers, Ford, Daimler, Chrysler, and General Motors, filed suit. International automobile companies have also joined the litigation to overturn California's clean car regulations. The final decision regarding legally whether we can move forward has yet to be determined. So in the meanwhile, the clock is ticking. I'm hoping that the manufacturing companies will go ahead in developing technologies and reassembling their assembly lines in order to meet the clean car regulations. So the courts should hear the case within the next year. the automobile manufacturers have hired top legal counsel, the Attorney General's Office, as well as Sierra Club, Environmental Defense, and Natural Resources Defense Council will join forces in hopefully making sure that the legislation stay in effect and that all states in the United States have the option of adopting California's clean car regulations.
Say a little more about the international automakers' opposition. It includes car makers who are making clean cars. It includes Toyota, you said, and also Honda?
The International Alliance, which includes all international car companies, have also joined suit with America's big three companies, much to my disappointment, and includes companies that tout their environmentally friendly cars. I happen to drive a Toyota Prius. It's a hybrid, and Toyota's part of the litigation, as well as Honda, and automobile companies that their home is in the EU. And interestingly enough, they're working within their own countries to meet the Kyoto Protocol targets, yet denying California and ultimately the United States from doing our fair share.
You mentioned the participation at some point of the environmental justice community coming on board and supporting it, but now you also mentioned that they have some disagreements with some of the possible solutions, including cap and trade policy. So what about that, and how do you think environmentalists and other people who aren't so much part of the environmental justice movement per se can come to an agreement on what to do?
That's going to be our biggest discussion as we're moving forward not only in the mobile sector but also stationary sources, is creating market incentives to make sure that the private sector works cooperatively. They're very interested in cap and trade. Big businesses who do business nationally and internationally know that the rest of the world is engaged in cap and trade. We're going to have a lot of discussion with the environmental justice communities that capping emissions, they support, that's a good thing, but what they don't want is all of a sudden new plants being built in their communities so they're disproportionately affected.
That was California Assemblywoman Fran Pavley. For more information on fuel efficiency legislation, contact the Natural Resources Defense Council at area code 212-727-2700 or visit their website at www.nrdc.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756. Or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly program summaries and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Bill Cosentino, Chris Ferriero, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.